All right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Wednesday, December 20th, 2017. And this is Before the First Cup with Jules here on UCY.TV. Happy Wednesday, everyone. It is a damp 42 degrees, overcast and gray here in upstate New York. So where do we leave off yesterday? We titled the show Robot Fired, Uncanny Valley, Emotional AI, Sophia, and Fedor. And we took a look at the K5 robot by Nightscope, who had gotten fired by the SPCA for harassing homeless people, or so they were accused of. And one of their presidents had actually said, oh, it's going to help clear the sidewalks and stuff. So they fired the robot, apparently, and it was the same K5 that ran over a little boy we talked about and also fell into a pond not too long ago. And then we took a look at some of the ability of artificial intelligence to be able to read emotions, looking at micro expressions and body language and that type of thing, as well as the uncanny valley. And that is that point where humanoid robots look a little too creepy to those 9 years old and up when they, according to a study, when they look more human-like than robotic. But then we touched on Sophia, who is a humanoid robot that has been to the UN and has her Saudi citizenship and is now fighting for women's rights, as well as the Russian Fedor that can hold guns in both hands and shoot. Well, I think we're going to continue along these lines today, looking at artificial intelligence and robotics, because you know this is something that's close to my heart, but because that was probably about the maximum amount of stories I could pull together today. So we finished the show looking at artificial intelligence and quantum computing and how they are using quantum computing to boost machine learning. And we have to be concerned about artificial general intelligence, which is something we spent some time on a few weeks ago listening to Ben Goertzel interviews and about some of the things that he is planning in development. We also found out that new AI can read and write its own code to increase its intelligence. And this is something we need to be concerned about. This is getting out of the hands of people, and now it is putting it into the hands of the machine. We discovered a while back that Google's Brain Project not only was writing its own software, but it was learning without any type of human intervention. That's where we have to be afraid. Well, we're going to continue a little bit more. We had a news story that came out on December 19th, which was yesterday. We found out that Google's DeepMind had won the game Go against the world champion a while ago, and IBM's Watson had won on Jeopardy, and I think the Google DeepMind also had won on chess. Well, this is a brand new one. Artificial intelligence beat human experts at poker. Now, I was thinking to myself when I read this title, ha, maybe they had robot googly eyes and they were paying attention to facial expressions, because that is where having a poker face comes from, and that is how you can be really good at the game. Libertarius, which is the artificial intelligence program that defeated four top professional poker players earlier this year, uses a three-pronged approach to master a game with more decision points than atoms in the universe, say scientists. In a study published in the journal Science, researchers from Carnegie Mellon University, and that's the dark heart of AI there, in the U.S., explained how their AI program was able to achieve superhuman performance by breaking the game into computationally manageable parts and, based on its opponent's gameplay, fixed potential weaknesses in its strategy during the competition. AI programs have defeated experts in checkers, chess, and Go, all challenging games, but one in which both players know the exact state of the game at all time. Poker players, by contrast, contend with hidden information, what cards their opponents hold, and whether an opponent is bluffing. In a 20-day competition, 120, I don't know, they have some weird commas here, 1,20,000 hands, so I don't know if that's 120,000. I would imagine 120,000 hands at Rivers Casino in Pittsburgh in January. Libertarius became the first AI program to defeat top human players in a heads-up, no-limit hold'em poker. Libertarius beat each of the players individually in the two-player game and collectively amassed more than $1.8 million in chips. Libertarius includes three main modules, the first of which computes an abstraction of the game that is smarter and easier to solve than by considering all the possible decision points, about a 10 multiplied 161 times in the game. It then creates its own detailed strategy for early rounds of Texas Hold'em poker and a course strategy for the later rounds, and the strategy is called the Blueprint Strategy. In the final rounds of the game, the second module constructs a newer, finer-grained abstraction based on the state of play. It also computes a strategy for the subgame in real time that balances strategies across different subgames using a blueprint strategy for guidance. So let's just say it was very complicated. Blah, 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 blah. So Libertarius added these missing decision branches, computing strategies for them, and then adds the blueprint. So, I don't know, that was kind of like a wah-wah-wah-wah story. But I guess it was interesting that poker is a much more complicated game in regards to not knowing what your opponents are doing, and it beat us as well at human strategy. So then there was another story. Regulations and artificial intelligence have not caught up with the speed of developments, because remember, it is coming very quickly. Make sure we do not lose the core of humanity. Sethu Vakunimar is a professor of robotics at Edinburgh University and director at the Edinburgh Center for Robotics. On a visit to India, he spoke to Shikivav Shakaran about the transformational potential of robots. What is the role being played by robots today? Shikinev asks. Well, robots have been playing a role in traditional manufacturing sectors, and what is changing now is that robots are becoming more ubiquitous in everyday life. They're also playing a role in things that are much closer to home, like surgery on the human body. So what is your role in NASA's Valkyrie project? And the reason why I picked this story is because I mentioned Valkyrie yesterday. That is the NASA rescue robot that they want to send to Mars to start building settlements. Well, that project is a smaller part of NASA's bigger vision to make us a two-planetary species. In other words, potentially inhabiting Mars' surface in a long-term perspective. So that's where we come in. The robots are going to go in doing things that human workers would do, and our role is to build algorithms and control systems that can really take these complex humanoid robots and give them dexterity, mobility, and biped locomotion, sensing and reacting to capabilities that humans take for granted. Is AI the final frontier in robotics? Yes. Well, he says if you think of AI, it's a bigger concept which embodies everything from taking the sensory data you're getting, processing it in a clever way, and giving additional value in order to do things in an interesting cognitive fashion. That is a broad way of thinking about AI. It's like the brain. And within that are subsets that deal with pure data streams, and that is what social network media is doing. But the point is not changing the state of the world, it's just data. Robotics is considered the arms and legs of the Internet of Things. Ding, ding, ding. Now, that's a neat way to think about it. I've never quite thought about it that way. But in other words, if you want to take process data and change the state of the world, then you need robotics and activation systems. That is where robotics fits in within the AI hierarchy. Well, this requires human programming. Can machines ever mimic the human ability to learn? Well, a significant part of the research I'm doing is looking at learning systems, and that's where deep learning comes in. In machine learning, and this system learns and adapts. The bigger aim of that approach is to equip a robotic system or an activation system with some core capabilities and then use the sensor data it receives to constantly evolve its behavior. The initial behaviors are built in by the human programmers, but the systems are able to evolve and adapt based on feedback it is getting and in the changing environment. There are significant aspects of that that are already reality in terms of autonomous driving cars. We have trials in the UK about systems collecting data and then driving. And there are special events which federal agencies have regulated. Wink. And these are intervention events where a person has to take control of something when it's going to go wrong. In those scenarios, it is not just that the machine learns. It feeds that into a database which network machines around the world can learn from. And eventually, if you have seen one kind of accident in an autonomous driving car, it is unlikely that the same sequence of events will be repeated in any of the other cars. Well, so now, talking about Valkyrie, I get a story about Valkyrie. This is from March 18th, 2017. So this is this year. In a Massachusetts warehouse, NASA's Valkyrie robot helps lay the groundwork for Mars settlement. NASA's Valkyrie, also known as the R5 robot, will never slip the surly bounds of Earth. The humanoid space robot is destined to spend the rest of its days on terra firma with the rest of us, but like the Robonaut before it, this 6-foot, 290-pound piece of machinery represents a link to the future. This is also the same piece of machinery that they have talked about before, dispatching when there is disaster with things such as FEMA. And what I thought was interesting about this robot Valkyrie is in an interview done with one of the programmers, the programmer kept referring to Valkyrie as a she. And in this article, they refer to Valkyrie as a she as well. It is full anthropomorphizing this humanoid robot. She, and that would be Valkyrie, is a first step toward a goal of human colonization of Mars and beyond, and a wonderful dream for the robot currently tethered to the ceiling of a warehouse in snowy Lowell, Massachusetts, about an hour outside of Boston. The Lowell model is one of four units produced by NASA, and the space agency held onto one of the robots for its own purposes, awarded two as research loans to the Northeastern University, as well as nearby MIT, while a fourth was acquired by Scotland's University in Edinburgh, same place where that interview we were just reading came from. Northeastern acquired the $2 million robot in 2015 when electrical and computer engineering professor Taskin Padar penned a proposal outlining a plan to help NASA test the hardware for its Space Robotics Challenge, which was an open competition designed to help prep Valkyrie's successors prepare for an important task of settling up hostile Mars terrain for human settlements. They've done all the hardware, and we are developing these high-level capabilities, so Valkyrie does more than just move limbs. All told, it is a pretty ideal arrangement for all parties involved. Northeastern and MIT get access to a $2 million state-of-the-art space robot, and NASA gets to outsource research for the platform to eager robotics and engineering students. Northeastern relocated its model to the NERV, which is the New England Robotics Validation and Experiment Center, a large warehouse space operated by the University of Mass Lowell that houses large obstacle courses designed to put robots to the test and drones through their paces. It is an ideal environment for testing Valkyrie's onboard vision systems and bipedal locomotion, setting up cramped and difficult to navigate surfaces to mimic the capsule and spacewalks that some future generation robot will hopefully encounter one day. Now, you're thinking, well, how are they going to send these robots up there? Well, I thought at one point I had read quite a bit about them looking at using virtual reality with humans on Earth, moving these robots as if they were avatars. Here's a story out of 2015, Project Morpheus. NASA will use PlayStation VR to control robots in space. And they had a partnership with Sony at the time. Sony kept a tight lip on the release date despite its mid-2016 launch, and this was out of 2015. But that hasn't stopped NASA from using it. The National Aeronautics Space Administration has worked with Sony to create a demo meant to show how controlling a humanoid robot in space would work. And after donning the goggles, players will see themselves inside of a spaceship. And by controlling the robot's arms, users are able to lift objects, move around, and more. The implications of this technology can make sending robots in space alongside or even without humans a viable option for small repair jobs and other smaller taxes. Don't worry, humans will still be able to travel to space, and we will see to that. So while we've seen companies introduce VR headsets in the past, Sony's is the only video game console maker to make their own. And with Microsoft investing in augmented reality using HoloLens and Nintendo keeping details on theirs close to the chest, Sony's VR efforts, formerly known as Project Morpheus, is almost ready for prime time, and that is ahead of the competition. With games like Drive Club and Eve Valkyrie and Super Hypercube making their way to the console, Sony could be the head start for the reasons for the company's success, but if only for the fact that it's another reason for NASA to send robots to space. Well, then we found out yesterday that Lockheed Martin is revolutionizing the search for alien life with its new artificial intelligence in partnership with NASA. NASA announced just a couple days ago, because this was from December 15, 2017, that they had a partnership with Google where Google created algorithms that would be combing the Kepler data and have already found two new planets in a solar system very much like ours, only a few hundred light years away. So now Lockheed Martin is jumping into the game. AI can revolutionize how we use information from space, both in orbit and in deep space missions, including crewed missions to Mars and beyond. Guys, they are really pushing this. Lockheed Martin and NEC are experts in space and systems, and that is the right blend to explore how AI can improve space products for astronauts and people on the ground. According to Lockheed, AI offers the technology to change the human role from in-the-loop controller to on-the-loop thinker, who can focus on a more reflective assessment of problems and strategies, guiding rather than being buried in the execution details. Well, guys, looks like we are going to Mars. They think that they're going to use AI and robots to do it. So Andrew Ng, we've talked about him before. Andrew Ng, who's an AI veteran from not only Google, but Baidu. AI veteran Andrew Ng just can't stop launching new companies. Unlike tennis balls and musketeers, AI ventures don't typically come in threes unless you are Andrew Ng. The former AI leader of both Google and Baidu have been on an entrepreneurial spree, making his third major announcement in recent months to launch Landing AI. This startup will help make large manufacturing companies more efficient by utilizing artificial intelligence. And previously, Ng launched DeepLearning.ai and announced that he would serve as chairman of Wobot. That's something that we talked about. Camille had sent that to me before. Wobot is the one that's going to be able to diagnose your depression just by using it as a chatbot online. Don't give it all of your deep, dark secrets. Remember that. You feed the machine. Wobot, which is an AI chatbot for mental health. He also serves as chairman of Coursera, which is an online education company he co-founded in 2012. Landing.ai's first partner is Foxconn, and that would be the company in China that makes Apple iPhones. But they are a Taiwanese-based company that most notably manufactures Apple products. Ng writes that his startup and Foxconn will jointly develop and deploy AI solutions and training globally. And I just found a story about that the other day. They don't have it up here, but they were going to be using artificial intelligence to scan the circuits after they had been produced and look for any anomalies or errors or bad solder joints or whatever to help bring down failure rates. Among the AI researchers credited with architecting today's AI boom, Ng is one of the most active in preaching the technology's benefits. He often repeats that AI is the new electricity, and we've been seeing that mantra a lot lately, as well as 5G, and that it is time to build an AI-powered society. It is now the time to build not just an AI-powered IT industry, but an AI-powered society, he writes, and he is helping usher this in, one in which our physical needs, our health care, our transportation, our food, and our lodging are more accessible through AI, and where every person is freed from repetitive mental drudgery. Yes, you don't use it, you're going to lose it. Don't forget that one. So don't let the AI or the robots feed you grapes. I'm telling you, it will be our downfall. This time for change, Ng is also highlighting the potential for job loss that AI makes manufacturing more efficient and reduces the need for human workers. Landing AI will focus on a job retraining program. Well, phew. And given Ng's role in co-founding Coursera, he says that his team is uniquely equipped to tackle these challenges. Now, I don't know if I pulled this story down, but there was another really good story that was in my feed this morning about jobs. I don't know. Hold on, guys. No, I went too far. Hold on. Oh, come on. Well, it's going to be in the streets. It's going to be in our communities. Oh, here we go. Revolutionizing jobs. So where was that Ng story so I can make sure I'm in the right spot? Here it is. All right, so our AI future, how artificial intelligence will revolutionize our jobs and what we can do about it. This was based upon a podcast from yesterday, December 19th, 2017, out of geekwire.com. And they air live, it appears, in Seattle on Saturdays. Artificial intelligence will change the world for better and for worse, and we need to be prepared. That is the takeaway from Oren Etzioni, CEO of the Allen Institute for Artificial Intelligence. So I guess they have an artificial intelligence arm, not only a brain arm, from the University of Washington. And he's also a computer science professor and our guest on this episode of the Geek Wire podcast. Etzioni is optimistic about the positive impacts of AI, like self-driving vehicles that could prevent thousands of fatal crashes each year. But he also says that AI will fundamentally change the world's economy, killing millions of jobs and potentially causing an economic revolution larger than we can predict. So what should we do about it? Well, AI will greatly reduce the demand for jobs, but what does that mean for the economy? Let's talk about what you are going to live off of, because that is a very bottom line question. Some people have proposed universal basic income, basically making sure that everyone gets a certain amount of money to live off of. And that would be this Orsini, thinks it's just a wonderful idea. The problem is we haven't been able to guarantee universal healthcare in this country, but don't worry about it, because we're going to do it with the AI revolution in healthcare. Our healthcare is under siege, and it is really hard to see how we're going to have a universal basic income if we don't have universal basic healthcare. I think that is the issue. It is not what I want. It is what the electorate and the political body will go for. And my hope is that we give money in exchange for services and that are currently not often available, or where maybe we can use volunteers, and that will be a more acceptable trade-off. So, why aren't tech jobs the answer? Well, what are we going to do as automation increases, as computers get more sophisticated? One thing that people say is we are going to retrain people, right? Yeah, that's what Ng said. Well, we'll take coal miners and then we'll turn them into data miners. Of course, we do need to retrain people technically. We need to increase technical literacy, but that is not going to work for everybody. We have a very large set of people in this country who either don't have college degrees or didn't finish high school, and I don't think that about all coal miners. And even more realistically, say the truck drivers whose jobs may be put out by self-driving trucks and cars, they are all going to become web designers and programmers? I think not. Well, what we could do is retrain people as caregivers. I was like, what? By caregivers, we mean that all ranges from babysitters all the way to people working as companions to the elderly or even nurses and highly trained individuals. The observations that I've made, now, I mean, honestly, is this their solution? They're going to turn coal miners into caregivers. The observation that I made is that true, that robots could pick up some of that, but there's still an essential element of caregivers that is uniquely human. That is the connection part. Even if my companion is a robot, I would rather my companion be a person, so that connection is genuine. It is warm, it is more human, and the biggest problem, first of all, is cost. So let's say our population is growing older, and we have a special needs child. We have various people who need to help, and the question is, who is going to pay for it? And we have to have a will in a society and a government to cover at least part of those costs of those services. And if we do that, then I think we really have an opportunity to take folks who, say, worked in trucking or, say, worked at McDonald's and help provide them with a pretty limited retraining to become people who deliver food but do so with a smile, who have a cup of coffee with an elderly person who takes him or her for a walk. So why bother? Is it even worth preparing for the AI revolution? Well, we do need to prepare. Let me give you an analogy, but it makes the point. Do we really need to know what is going to happen when the big one hits Seattle? What is it going to do to the nature of that earthquake? And what is going to break down and so on? No, we don't. We do need to go through the exercises. We do need to prepare. But do we need to make sure we have food and water? Well, heck yeah. These are slow processes. But if we are talking about retraining, if we are talking about creating programs, then we don't have to have the conversation now. We need to start preparing and say, instead of saying, hey, it'll just work out if it's worked out before. But the other point is, and I am not an expert historian, but my understanding is that in the past, there was a lot of disruption and a lot of pain in the process. It is easy for us now, decades or even a century later, to say, hey, look, it all worked out 100 years ago in the Industrial Revolution. Can we minimize the pain that was involved? And for the most vulnerable people, I think it's going to be a long time before GeekWire is fully automated, but I think it's going to be a lot shorter time before millions of truck drivers are out of a job. So on companies using your personal data, really the people who are enabling this is you and me by continuing to provide Google and Facebook with our information. It is a little bit like the war on drugs, right? We can do whatever we want. We can build a wall. We can intercept shipments and so on. It's not saying that we shouldn't at least do something, but the bottom line is, as long as there is a huge demand for cocaine, then people from outside of the country will find a way to get it in. So as long as you and I are willing to trade our most private information and queries for a free search engine and a free social service, then there are going to be people that are going to figure out how to monetize that data. So last question and answer in this story. How should we restrict and regulate AI? The interviewer asks. Well, first of all, I said, don't regulate AI. Right, don't regulate it. It is such a vibrant, fast-moving field. It is not even clear exactly where the boundary is between AI and computer science. When we think about those applications, let's say in cars or in shopping, there are some sensible rules that we should think about. But one of them, for example, is around the liability. If my AI car, God forbid, runs over your kitten, whose fault is that? I wanted to say that my AI did it, but it is not an excuse. I can't say, hey, look, this is sophisticated technology. I don't understand it. Don't blame me. Blame the AI. It has to be the case that we take his responsibility. And if we use AI technologies, we take responsibility for those actions. That is rule number one. I'm not going to sign up for that one. Are they going to make you like ink a usability agreement? If my AI kills somebody, well, then it's all my fault. I can be blamed for it. I don't know about that one. So the second case and how and why we should regulate is becoming harder and harder to tell. And it is that, is it a person or a Twitter bot? We saw, of course, in the election, I think it is important for us to have a rule. If a system is really an AI bot, it ought to be labeled as such, like AI inside. It shouldn't pretend to be a person. And it is bad enough having a person calling you and harassing you and emailing you. But what if they were bots? An army of bots constantly haranguing you, and that is terrible. Then the third piece is around privacy that we talked about earlier. AI has even bigger capabilities to draw information from us. Two quick examples. One is AI Barbie. We talked about that when it first came out a year or two ago. We have toys, including Barbie, and now these AI cats that we might actually get to that interact with our kids. Well, what happens when the information they elicit from our innocent children gets put up into the cloud? That seems highly problematic, and even something that innocent or like a Roomba that might be going around your house cleaning your floors, surely that's not a big deal, except that it was reported by the New York Times, and we covered this story as well, that Roomba is planning on selling your information about your house in the form of a map to third parties. You would never dream of it, and again, as threats to our privacy increase, we need to have clear rules about what AI is allowed to disclose about us and what should be kept private. We also read a few stories a while back about the one of the voice activated, I think it was Alexa. Alexa's records got called to court to try to prove a murder case. That's going to make you wonder, like, as these devices are surrounding us, and of course the Internet of Things is becoming ubiquitous, where is that going to leave us in regards to our privacy and some sort of Minority Report future, because they will be able to get access to all of these records. Uh-oh. I'm starting to... Lock, dude. Sorry, I hate when this happens, guys. Chrome is not responding. All right, I get to the story I was just going to read, then hung everything up. So the Internet of Things is coming to every facet of our lives in the future. So I ran across this today. Top 8 IoT trends for 2018. Survey by the IHS, and they don't tell you what that is, estimates that there are 20 billion connected devices globally as of this year. Will 2018 be the year of IoT? Well, not exactly, but the future looks promising, and 2018 will show a promising trajectory. Despite the huge gains in connectivity, the truth is 2018 will be more of a steady rather than an explosive growth in 2018. Full of fits and spasms and everything that goes along with them, it will see a lot of investment and lots of growth and widespread adoption in a few major industries, but it will also see some growing pains, fragmentation and frustration, potential data breaches, and security issues galore, of course. Security everywhere. So let's let the government get involved. So will 2018 be an exciting year? Well, yes-ish. The truth is we are right smack in the midst of a revolution, no matter how imperfect it may initially seem. And if that isn't exciting, I don't know what is. Oh, get excited. The following are the top 8 trends that you will see in the coming year. Number 1, IoT will grow. In what might be the most obvious prediction for the decade, the IoT will continue to expand next year with more and more devices coming online every single day. What isn't so obvious about this prediction is where this growth will occur. The retail, healthcare, and industrial supply chain industries will likely see the greatest growth. Forrester Research has predicted that IoT will become the backbone of customer value as it continues to grow. It is no surprise that retail is jumping on board, hoping to harness the power of IoT to connect with consumers, grow their brands, and improve the customer journey in deeply personal ways. And how are they going to do that in deeply personal ways? Oh, they would be looking at the sound of your voice to define your emotions and learning about you by conversing with chatbots, learning your preferences, using different types of machine learning and deep learning techniques. But with patients wearing wearable devices and tracking products from the factory floor, there will be many ways, and the full potential of IoT is still to be realized, and we will see more of that in 2018. It will also become more fragmented. Just as the Internet of Things continues to grow, it'll also become increasingly fragmented. And as we have seen with the growth of software as a service programs and cloud solutions, that fragmentation will create some hurdles for many companies as they deal with compatibility issues throughout the industry. Though companies like Qualcomm are leading the push for IoT device standards, of course they are. They're also leading the push for 5G standards and certifications. In many ways, the genie has already left the bottle. Oh, but we knew that, and you can't stuff that genie back in. It is now a matter of wrangling her back into place if we want to put those standards in place. All right, so the next one, which leads to greater security concerns. As I've said before, fragmentation leads to system compromise almost every single time, and the more complex, the more network security challenges. Indeed, securing all of these connected devices in an environment with minimal regulation will be difficult, and finding a solution to keep data safe will be the main goal in the coming year. But don't worry about it, because DARPA was going to be scanning 80% of all the IP addresses on the internet and then putting a little bug in the back door to be able to scan it and make sure it wasn't infected with bots. The next one, mobile platforms will make more sense, right? 5G is going to connect everything. It's going to be mobile connection. The trend from mobile first to mobile only will likely continue to grow as mobile platforms will become the de facto standard for system management for IoT devices. Again, this isn't shocking, but it isn't finished yet. The development of IoT is one that will happen over time as early adopters begin to refine and latecomers jump into the mix. The coming year will continue to see many transitions into the mobile platform developments. Marketing efforts, of course, will continue, and companies will be pushed to the edge with data. Because of the huge influx of data being created through IoT, it makes sense that companies will need to find a better, closer, cheaper way to process it, and that is where edge networking will be less of a trend and more of a necessity. As companies seek to reduce costs and reduce network usage, today we are seeing companies like Cisco, HPE, and Dell leading this migration of computing infrastructure to the edge. Legacy industrial IoT firms like GE and ABB are also continuing to develop hardened infrastructure to handle challenging environments that are less ideal to hosting computers than traditional data centers. And basically what they are going to do in regards to that is provide embedded computers in miniaturized formats so they can be dispatched in any type of device. It's kind of like when they first figured out how to run an IIS server to get internet connectivity for things such as your refrigerator in very small packages, just on a small chip. All right, so, but here's the end result. Lots and lots of money will be had, and it will be falling from the sky like the early days of the internet. Business Insider predicts business spending on IoT solutions will hit $6 trillion by 2021. It makes sense then that venture capitalists will continue to pour funds into the promise of IoT, underscoring its potential to improve customer experience in almost every industry, as well as garner every bit of intelligence they can about you and your daily life, and building behavioral dossiers. Like I said, this won't be a silver year bullet for IoT. It is rarely for any technology, but some major inroads will be created that should help build larger and more solid foundations for the technology in the next 5 years. So you'll have a smart city coming to a town near you. And after that, it is anyone's guess what might happen. We might be talking about a whole new technology altogether. So, all right, so where does that lead us? Well, now we're going to globetrot across the globe to India. Soon, AI-based cameras will scan the streets of Delhi and Mumbai. Now, we already read about the City Brain in collaboration with Alibaba and Hangzhou China, where it's going to be surveilling everything about the city using video cameras and facial recognition technology. Well, this is out of the Economic Times of the India Times. Brazilian security company Polsec will start testing its cameras based on artificial intelligence on the streets of Mumbai, Delhi, and Agra starting next month. Initially, 100 units of cameras called Smart Eyes will be installed, and the company will add more cameras to these cities, and the once all necessary features are added. Smart Eyes can detect unusual movements, breaking of traffic rules, halting or parking vehicles in unauthorized areas, and etc., making it easier for authorities to deal with problems. And explaining how it works, their lead advisory board, Werner, said, for instance, the camera, after a few times, will learn how many people cross the street every day at this hour. But if it, and that would be the number, suddenly triples, the camera will detect this unusual, anomalous behavior and report it. Similarly, it'll detect if cars are halted or parked in no parking zones, and the fully rotatable camera will then send a few alerts to the driver through its speaker. But if no action is taken, it will immediately contact the nearby traffic police or government official to take action. This process is entirely automated and happens within seconds. Features to these cameras can be added after seeing what behavior is seen on the streets. So far, the Indian governments are quite keen to look into garbage debris, parking issues, and vehicle behavior. All these cameras that work majorly based on knowledge, experience, and intuition will be connected across the city and allow a flow of seamless data. And each of these new age cameras only costs about $280. Polsec is also working with governments such as Switzerland and as well as those in Latin America, including Colombia. To protect the privacy of citizens, these cameras have a function to cover the face of people. Well, they didn't enable that one in China. But if a critical situation arises, we can disable this feature. Of course they can. The data that gets collected by the camera is first extracted and classified in real time, and then it will be readily consumed, shared, and managed. And depending on the government's protocol, the data can either be managed by a local municipality or by the federal government. Yeah, won't that be convenient in the United States? The system is designed to protect data in a very high military-grade encrypted environment, he says, and there is no additional system to access the data because its own neural network is always protected and can be accessed locally by an intranet or remotely by the internet with the same level of protection. One of the common pain points is that these cameras help reduce vandalism and street violence. In one of the Brazilian cities, the camera reduced crime by 70%, adding that it was expected to have similar results in India. Last month, tech giants Amazon and Google also launched AI cameras. While Google's camera, which is called the Google Clips, costs $249 and caters to parents, Amazon's Deep Lens is priced at $250 and it is aimed at developers. So where is that going to lead us to? Well, that is going to lead us to places like here. Researchers at Carnegie Mellon University have now taught robots, and I'm assuming that there's a program behind this, such as an AI, to speak body language of humans. This body tracking software could help robots read your emotions. If your friend says she feels relaxed but her fists are clenched, you may doubt her sincerity. Well, robots, on the other hand, might take her word for it. Body language says a lot, and even with advances in computer vision and facial recognition technology, robots struggle to notice body movement and can miss important social cues as a result. Researchers at Carnegie Mellon developed a body tracking system that might help solve this problem called OpenPose. The system can track body movements, including your hands and your face, in real time. It uses computer vision and machine learning to process video frames, and it can even track multiple people simultaneously. Yeah, coming to a street camera near you. This capability could ease human-robot interactions and pave the way for more interactive virtual and augmented reality, as well as intuitive user interfaces. One notable feature of OpenPose system is that it can track not only a person's head, torso, and limbs, but also their individual fingers. And to do that, researchers used Carnegie Mellon's Panoptic Studio, which is a dome lined with 500 cameras where they captured body poses at a variety of angles and then used those images to build their data sets. And then they passed those images through what they called a key point detector to identify and label body parts. And the software also learns to associate body parts with individuals, so it knows, for example, that a particular person's hand will always be close to his or her elbow. This makes it possible to track multiple people at once, and I bet it can recognize tattoos as well. The image from the dome was captured in 2D, but then the researchers looked at the detected key points and triangulated them into 3D to help their body tracking algorithms understand how each pose appears from different perspectives. And with all this data processed, the system can now determine how the whole body, hand looks when a particular position, even if the fingers are obscured. So to say this technology could be applied to all sorts of interactions between humans and machines, it could play a huge role in VR experiences, allowing for finer detection of a user's physical movements without any additional hardware like stick-on sensors or gloves. It could also facilitate more natural interactions with a home robot. You could tell your robot to pick that up, and it could immediately understand what you're pointing at. But by perceiving and interpreting all your physical gestures, the robot may even learn to read emotions by tracking your body language. Yeah, that's what I'm worried about. And so when you're silently crying with your face and your hands because a robot has taken your job, it might then offer you a tissue. That was a good ending. All right, so now let's talk about more invasive surveillance by China this time. China, this is from December 13th, 2017, out of Newsweek.com. China is gathering blood, DNA and iris scans for a massive database of millions in their Muslim province. Chinese police have started gathering blood types, DNA samples, fingerprints, and iris scans of millions of people in its Muslim-majority Xinjiang province to build a massive citizen database, according to a report from the activist group Human Rights Watch. The report, published Wednesday last week, said officials are collecting data from citizens between the ages of 12 and 65 using a variety of methods. Authorities are gathering DNA and blood types through free medical checkups. Look out! And it is said that it was unclear if patients were aware that their biometric data was being collected for the police during these physical exams. Well, I'm going to probably doubt that. And according to the report, citizen authorities have flagged it as a potential threat to their regime and their families, named focus personnel, that are forced to hand over their DNA regardless of age. So far, 18.8 million citizens have participated in these medical checkups called Physicals for All by the government, according to an article by a state news agency, Xinhua, on November 1st. Xinjiang authorities should rename their physical exam project Privacy Violations for All, as informed consent and real choice does not seem to be a part of these programs. The mandatory data banking of a whole population's bio data, including their DNA, is a gross violation of international human rights norms, and it is even more disturbing if it is done surreptitiously under the guise of a free healthcare program. Don't think that isn't coming to the United States. That last story that we read about robots taking all of our jobs and giving out universal basic income, and oh, woe is me, we don't have a universal healthcare system. Remember, they are looking at things such as neural dust and being able to monitor all kinds of biostatistics at a distance and put it in a dashboard, like a gauge on a car that can tell when something is going wrong before you know it. So don't think that your DNA, which we had a program here in the United States called the All of Us program, very much like their Physicals for All, that was to get you to give up your DNA as part of a research project. The rights group is concerned about data collection such as iris scans, DNA, and blood types, and it could be used for surveillance of persons because of their ethnicity, religion, opinion, or other protected exercise of rights like free speech, according to adding to controls in the region some analysts have dubbed an open-air prison. Yes, welcome to our future. Xinjiang, which is a territory in northwest China, is a colossal region of deserts and mountains, and it is known for being home to many ethnic minority groups, over 11 million Muslim, Turkic, Uyghur people. And because of this, Xinjiang has long been a subject to tight control and intense levels of surveillance not experienced elsewhere in China. In April, police banned its citizens from wearing long beards or veils in public, a move that activist groups saw as a means of targeting Muslim populations in particular. Authorities also banned homeschooling and use of the Ongjar language in schools, as well as introducing new restrictions on downloading what it considers to be extremist material. Well, that's interesting. I don't know how close this Ongjar is to Mongolia, but I was looking at UCY YouTube stats the other day, and I saw we had quite a bit of traffic from Mongolia, which I have to say, hello, Mongolia, and give you kudos for finding UCY. The biometric collection scheme is detailed in an official document that was posted in Xinjiang's government website, with the human rights group making an unofficial translation available. So now, this was a story that came out December 14th, 6 days ago, again out of Newsweek. China has used its vast CCTV surveillance network to track down a reporter in just 7 minutes. I mean, this is literally Minority Report. BBC reporter John Sudworth was located and captured by Chinese police in just 7 minutes into a stunt to demonstrate the power and effectiveness of the government's surveillance systems. Tasked with trying to remain undetected for as long as possible in Xinjiang, a capital city of about 3.5 million in southwestern China, Sudworth filmed himself with a selfie stick trying to evade the Chinese CCTV cameras fitted with artificial intelligence and facial recognition technology. But as predicted, his exercise was ended swiftly, and after just 7 minutes Authorities surrounded Sudworth and escorted him out of the building that he had been hiding in. So what do you think about that? 7 minutes across the surveillance video network. So now, talking about AI, we talked about Robo Barbie that would be connected to the internet, and your child would be feeding the Robo Barbie their most personal secrets and making it a friend. Scientists are now hoping to inject, and I thought that that was quite an interesting use of the term inject, hope to inject RoboCat with artificial intelligence to help seniors. Typically, you see inject used in technology when it comes to like some sort of injection attack that happens to a database from a hacker. Toy maker Hasbro and scientists at Brown University have received a $1 million grant from the National Science Foundation to find ways to add artificial intelligence to Hasbro's Joy for All. Notice how there's all this for all garbage going on. Robotic cat is a way to help older adults with simpler tasks. The cat that is currently on the market is aimed at seniors and meant to act as a companion. This new 3-year project aims to develop additional capabilities to help older adults with simpler tasks, and they are working out what those tasks might be, but say it could include finding lost objects or reminding the owner to call her daughter or go to a doctor's appointment. Scientists hope that they can help older adults remain in their homes a lot longer. So they're going to have robo cats for old people. Well, now let's take it another step. This was 4 days ago. What will tomorrow's children make of RoboPets? Now, we read a story yesterday that had found that children under 9 tend to not find humanoid-esque robots creepy, and they tend to trust them, but children over 9 into adulthood don't. Well, now, what about a RoboPet? From Abo to Cosmo, what does the future hold for bot pets? Well, I have done everything I can. My robot is bored. And that is the author of the story, Rich Wordsworth. Anki's Cosmo, Wally meets Eve in the cab of a forklift, costs about $180 and brings its own light-up cubes that it's perennially rearranging and stacking. It also has a camera in its head, and it can recognize my face. But when it does, it grins with its eyes and excitedly slaps the table with its forklift, shouting, "Rich, yay!" Well, I am now ignoring it while I write, and it is rolling around the tabletop, flipping over its cubes and turning around every so often to see if I'm paying attention and if it is playtime again. I feel terrible. My robot is bored. Oh, no. The more I play with Cosmo, the more I get sucked into the machine and the more connected I feel to this trundling little ball of emotive plastic. I know that he is really just circuitry and sensors in a cutesy shell, but the circuitry and sensors in my cutesiest shell have turned him into a pet. So if I squint, I can see Cosmo for what he really is, and that is a clever machine, but he's also a handy mascot for an increasingly pertinent question. If Cosmo can blur the lines between animal and machine for me, then what about the kids who will be unwrapping him for Christmas? As interactive robots get smarter and more convincing year on year, how does a parent on Christmas Day meaningfully explain that just because a toy is made from plastic, they should bond with it in a way that is different from bonding with their pet hamster, rabbit, or dog? And should parents even be trying it in the first place? Well, I'm going to say no. When we designed Cosmo, we really didn't design it especially for kids. We designed it as a pet, and a pet is something that appeals to a lot of different ages, says Mark Petucci, founder and head of the cloud AI machine learning at Anki. When I was young, we had a lot of stuffed animals, in particular a lot of stuffed dogs, and I remember losing one and crying for 3 days. I did too. And kids at younger ages don't necessarily need as much to establish an emotional bond with an inanimate object. Inanimate is clearly what Cosmo is, and that doesn't help explain to a child why Cosmo isn't alive. It is apparently doesn't stop a child or an adult from looking through the reviews and from developing some sort of emotional bond, and in fact, it might even help. Nowadays, children are used to the concepts of robots. Thank Star Wars for that one. And in my research, I found that if robots look like real humans, now this says that he found that children felt uncomfortable, but we found yesterday that it said children did not feel uncomfortable under nine. They were comfortable with the concepts of robots and that they can speak and move and make gestures, but if they look like humans, children would say that is terrifying in his experiments. On the evidence of Tung's study and the popularity of pet robots, the sci-fi grail of perfect androids can pass for humans, or it follows for hamsters, and it isn't as important as we might think. As long as the robots can react and emote in some way, children are happy to ascribe them character and personality, but what can be confused, according to Petrucci, are children's expectations of what their new robot friend should and shouldn't be able to do. A younger child, maybe 6 or 7 years old, really doesn't know what to expect. Why can't he do this and this and this? And it doesn't recognize how enormously difficult the technological requirements are in order for the robot to do those things. But they are used to seeing these characters in feature films and animated movies, and they don't necessarily have the sense of what the difference is between real physical worlds and what you would see in a movie. They have not quite made the distinction between reality and fantasy. And that is where you got to worry about this. They are blending these worlds. We had heard back a few days ago in the one conversation or interview with one of the addiction experts in regards to children and being addicted to the internet and games and that type of thing, that a lot of these kids that are younger and get very into gaming become immersed in these games, and they have a lot of trouble of distinguishing between reality and the virtual world. Perhaps robot pets are some newly emerging third type of thing, one that makes more sense to children who never lived in anything but an ever-connected digital world of phones, tablets, and voice-activated assistants. And if so, how should they be treated? Where do robots fit into a child's pecking order of things? I think that children will still be smart enough to tell the difference between robot dogs and real dogs, and they are already familiar with intelligent toys, so it won't need to explain this to them. But I do hope that they treat the robots just the same way they treat a real dog, because somehow the robot dogs can still trigger a social response from children. You don't consider toys to be alive, but for interactive toys, somehow we project personality onto them so the children want to treat them nicely. Treat your coming robot overlords nicely.